May it please the court. My name is Ben Cohen, registration number 26511. Here on behalf of the appellants, Ivor and Donna Larson. With me at council table is trial counsel Dan Dean from the Fort Collins firm of Dean and Reed, and also our client, Ivor Larson. Your honors, when the government exercises the strong arm of its eminent domain power, it needs to do so very carefully. And one of the reasons that we have three branches of government is to ensure that this kind of care is taken in a condemnation proceeding. There's two issues on this appeal. One is whether the trial court should have allowed the Larsons to assert a supplemental claim for inverse condemnation. And the second question is whether the Larsons should be able to recover their attorney's fees as a condition of Johnstown's abandonment of condemnation and voluntary dismissal of the case under Rule 41A2. I'm going to address the fee issue first. This court has said, and I quote, "The concept of just compensation is essentially one of fairness. Therefore, a property owner should not be required to incur costs when the condemning authority does not proceed properly." That's from a case that we didn't cite in our briefs, actually. It's Platte River Power Authority v. Nelson, 775 P. 2nd, 82. In this case, Johnstown did not proceed properly because it undertook an experimental condemnation, and that is not proper. Now, we use the term experimental condemnation frequently in our briefs, but we didn't make that term up. That phrase comes from a 19th century Colorado Supreme Court case, Denver New Orleans Railroad versus Lamborn from 1885. And the court used the term experimental condemnation to describe the situation that we have here, where a condemnor tries to see how little it can get away with paying for property instead of actually offering fair market value. The condemnor makes a lowball offer, and of course, most landowners don't fight a government entity that has condemnation power because they can't afford to. But
is there anything supporting that statement in the record?
That's just an observation that I offer the court. There's nothing of record to support that.
Okay, thank you.
But obviously in this case, the Larsons, I would submit, are one of the rare exceptions. They did fight, and they fought for the fair market valuation of their property. And they brought a lot of resources to bear on that. They paid myself and Mr. Dean a lot of attorney's fees.
Well, counsel, it sounds like you're arguing for an exception to the American rule that applies in condemnation cases, or as you put them, experimental condemnation cases. What authority is there for such an exception to the American rule in these cases?
It is true. The American rules, both sides pay their own fees. The exception here is Rule 41A2, that a trial court can grant a plaintiff's request for voluntary dismissal of a case, but does so on such terms as are just. In a case like this, where Johnstown brings an experimental condemnation proceeding, a low ball offer, we have to litigate for 3 years all the way up to this court to get a fair valuation trial and a cert petition to the Colorado Supreme Court. So finally, when it gets remanded back and framed for a fair valuation trial with real evidence, that's when Johnstown says, guess we don't really need to condemn this property after all. That's what makes it an experimental condemnation proceeding, and that's what makes a fee award entirely appropriate under Rule 41A2 and the direct and applicable authority of the Lamborn case. Even though it's a 19th century case, it is still controlling, and it is just as apposite as it is today, even more so, because, at least my sense is, back in the 19th century, attorney's fees were not nearly as large a part of the overall consideration in the case and in maintaining justice as they are now.
Mr. Cohen, you say that that the town made a lowball offer, but both the trial court, the initial trial court, and the subsequent trial court said that it was a good faith offer. And doesn't that undercut your argument significantly that this was a quote lowball offer?
The findings by the lower court that it was a good faith offer doesn't really go to the amount and whether the amount was fair market value. That's something that would have been determined by the jury on remand with a completely new array of evidence. Mr. Larson's higher valuations would have been admissible under this court's prior opinion, and also the court was instructed to reconsider the much larger issue of the regulatory taking, which could have given rise to just compensation damages a full order of magnitude beyond what Johnstown had offered.
Are you asking us as an appellate court to make an independent determination that this was a lowball offer justifying a conclusion that it was an experimental condemnation?
No, you do not need to make an independent finding. There's two reasons for that, Your Honor. One is that Johnstown's action in abandoning the condemnation in the face of the trial really does speak for itself, and you can simply allow that decision to speak for itself. Secondly, as we have highlighted in our briefs, the lowball nature of the offer is really established by Johnstown's own party admissions in this case. Several things. First of all, there's the fact that Johnstown, while it offered $44,000, it did have a higher valuation that supported a $51,000 offer. And that appears, as we have pointed out in our briefs, in the record. It appears in the condemnation petition, and it appears in Johnstown's initial disclosures. That we believe that that was because of some sort of miscommunication between Johnstown and its counsel, that they withdrew that higher valuation. But that's, what, $7,000, roughly, to begin with. Add to that the fact that this litigation went on for 3 years. Part of Johnstown's offer, $44,000, was $5,000 a year in basically rental value for the use of the land while Johnstown was going to put in the sewer pipeline. Well, this litigation took 3 years. 3 years of $5,000 a year, that's $10,000 more. If you just take those two pieces of valuation evidence that are Johnstown's own party admissions and add them to what Johnstown offered, you would get to the 130% threshold that is enough of a lowball offer, according to the General Assembly, that it justifies fee shifting under rule, the statute is 38.1.122 sub 1.5. Now, we're not arguing. Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead and finish your statement.
I just wanted to point out that we're not arguing that that statute applies here. It does not apply here because we did not have a final determination, evaluation on the remand trial. We're just pointing out that the court can be confident that had there been a second valuation trial, a jury would have been well justified in finding sufficient value, a sufficiently high valuation for fee shifting under the statute, without even considering the fact that Mr. Larson would have given a higher valuation comparables, without even considering the whole issue of the regulatory taking, just based on Johnstown's own party admissions.
The question is this, Mr. Cohen. You're indicating that the Johnstown's abandonment of the condemnation proceedings speaks for itself, and seemingly inferring some bad faith on the part of Johnstown. And if that is correct, how do you reconcile your position with the Supreme Court's statements in Johnson versus Climax that under our eminent domain statute, the condemnor retains the right to abandon the project and discontinue the proceedings at any time prior to the payment or deposit of the sum finally awarded by the certificate of commissioners or the jury as compensation for the taking?
A couple of points to address that, Your Honor. One factor is that this case had already gone to trial and a judgment had been awarded and was coming back for a second trial.
Wasn't it an immediate possession hearing?
Oh, there was an immediate possession hearing, and Johnstown obtained immediate possession. But then after, in fact, that's a good place to start, Your Honor, to just look at why we think that Johnstown's actions and abandonment are materially different from other cases where a condemner has exercised what the Supreme Court has characterized as a right to abandon. So let's start from the immediate possession. Johnstown decided that it needed to condemn property for a sewer line and that the line had to go right through the middle of the Larson's 100-acre parcel. No other routes would do. As we've pointed out in our briefs, the record establishes that the Larson's asked Johnstown to consider alternative routes. No other route would do. Had to cut across the middle. And that was, of course, incredibly problematic for the Larson's because that destroyed their ability to develop because Johnstown wouldn't let them use this very sewer that they were putting through the property. Johnstown saw
actually they could have used the sewer
if they had condemned. I think it's clear, at least by this point of the proceedings, that if they had annexed, the Larsons are not going to annex into Johnstown. Once again, we submit that this case shows why. Johnstown did not even take possession once it was awarded immediate possession. What it did instead was preserve its ability to walk away and abandon the condemnation by trying to whittle down the Larson's evidence of value to ensure that it wouldn't have to pay more than its offer. And it did that through the motion in limine process, which this court ultimately reversed and sent us back down for the retrial. Before I spend all of my time on this matter, are there any other questions regarding fees? Because I would like to address the other issue of supplementation.
Yes, I have a question regarding fees. Are you claiming, is it your position that the attorney's fees that you are claiming are damages?
They are damages. We are not claiming them as damages on this appeal. On this appeal, we're claiming that the court should have conditioned Johnstown's voluntary abandonment on a fee award, an ordinary fee award, under Rule 41A2, and that it was a manifest abuse of discretion not to do so. Especially we're here, all of this legal authority comes into play, and we submit constraints to the court. Now, we also contend that they constitute damages in an action recognized by the very molybdenum case that Your Honor pointed out. That case recognizes that in this situation, a landowner can bring a separate action for damages, and that the Larsons have done that. There is a separate proceeding that is currently stayed below because the trial judge wants to find out how this court is going to rule and take some direction.
Are you aware of any authority in the state of Colorado where Rule 41 has been used to award a landowner damages in a condemnation proceeding where a condemnor has abandoned the proceeding?
Not damages, Your Honor, and nor do I know of a specific case where Rule 41A2 has been used to support a fee award, but Rule 41A2 is commonly used to support awards of fees as a condition of a plaintiff's decision to voluntarily abandon a case, especially when the case has been going on for quite some time, as this one has. We cite a couple cases. One of them was a water case, specifically holding that there doesn't even have to be any other specific substantive basis for fee shifting. The court can simply decide that it is justice requires that fees be paid as a condition of voluntary abandonment late in the case, which is what we think is eminently appropriate here. Given the short amount of time, I am not even going to address the motion to supplement, but reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Counsel, yes. I have questions about the motion to supplement.
Certain objections.
What I'm having trouble getting my head around is what your legal theory is for that supplementation, because it seems to me, as you allege in your brief, that the problem here is the Weld County Code provision that mm-hmm. prevents development, and yet you want to sue Johnstown.
Yes.
It seems to me you're precluded from developing by virtue of the Weld County Code. So how can Johnstown be responsible for what's in the Weld County Code?
Because Johnstown has been making the decision in this case, or made the decision, to condemn land outside of its municipal boundaries for its sewer. Now, what Johnstown
is not doing that. It's not doing that anymore.
It is abandoned. Right. During the case, it wanted to run a sewer line through the Lawson's property outside of the city of Johnstown, take property outside of its own town boundaries for a sewer. Now, our position is this: when a city like Johnstown decides to do so, there are consequences that come along with that. Specifically, under the Weld County Code, when it lays a sewer line down outside of its town boundaries and doesn't let people use that sewer, then there is a de facto 400-foot no development zone that surrounds that sewer line. Now, the Larsons could have used that sewer if they were.
But that's not the town's doing, though. That 400-foot zone exists by virtue of a Weld County Code provision,
right?
Not the town of Johnstown provision.
Because of that, the Weld County provision pre-existed Johnstown's decision to require annexation as a condition of using the sewer. But our point is that when a town decides to take land outside of its boundaries, it needs to be aware of the effect on development that its taking will have, and that's exactly what we sought to introduce in the valuation trial below.
But it hasn't taken any of your client's property.
It hasn't taken the property, but for purposes of inverse condemnation or condemnation analysis in general, you don't have to physically take property in order to take the value of property. It took the development value of that land because the Larsons couldn't develop any property within 400 feet of wherever Johnstown decided to place that sewer line.
Well, now, wait a minute. How do we know that? I mean, you've got a Weld, the ordinance says, the Weld County ordinance says, if feasible,
You know, what's to prevent your client from going back to Weld County and saying it's not feasible because look where they placed their sewer line, allow us to develop? I mean, and if the county allows you to develop, you don't have a claim against the town of Johnstown.
Oh, we agree, Your Honor.
So that's all premature.
It's not premature. That is exactly what was teed up and would have been a subject of the second evaluation trial.
Well, how can, but you have to actually ask the county, will you allow us to develop? And they have to say no. And until they say no, how do you have a claim?
We have a claim because the Larsons did talk to county officials, and the county officials told them that they would not be permitted to develop. And that is the evidence, as you will recall, and as laid out in our briefs. County planner Tom Hahn was a will call witness. The Larsons would have put him on the stand. We would have put on evidence of exactly how the Weld County regulation and the Johnstown's sewer regulation interacted in this case. We would have done that if we could have had the retrial, the remand evaluation trial. Johnstown's abandonment prevented that, which goes to what Judge Hawthorne noted as what makes this abandonment truly problematic and worthy of a fee award. I say I'm out of time, although if there are more questions. Being no questions, thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court. R. Russell Anson, attorney for the town of Johnstown, registration number 5672. One issue I'd like to hit right away before we move on is because of the fact that the statement made about Tom Hahn, county planner. I know Tom Hahn personally, and he was at that hearing, the initial trial, but he was never called as a witness, and no offer of proof was ever made. Counsel for the Larsons rested their case. Rather surprising to me, with those witnesses out in the hall that they never called, but that's when I made the motion for directed verdict, which was granted by the court. That was the first appeal. They appealed on a number of issues. They only prevailed on one issue, disclosure. This Court of Appeals determined that the ruling of civil procedure regarding disclosure did not require the property owner who is testifying as a lay witness, not as an expert, to disclose the properties that he was using as comparables. That's the only issue they prevailed on. They appealed on about a half a dozen issues. That's the only one they prevailed on.
But now, that was a pretty big issue because it really did impact greatly the scope of the evidence that would be permitted on the issue of valuation. I mean, Mr. Larson was to testify that the taking was valued at multiple millions of dollars. So it's a pretty big deal. It's one issue, but it's a big issue.
And that's exactly correct, except for one thing. That's that $7.7 million verdict they were anticipating they could get out of this case. But it's futile. It's totally futile. Why is it futile? As the court already mentioned, they never applied for an application with the County of Weld. They never applied formally to the town of Johnstown to give them sewer service.
Mr. Anson, would they be able nevertheless to produce evidence if we were to allow a supplementation, for example? Yeah. Would they not be able to produce evidence that the Weld County authorities had said, we will not let you develop, just flat won't do it? And so therefore an application would be futile?
We could get down the whole nine yards. Let's say we look at our regulations, which they're complaining about. First of all, the policy of Weld County, the resolution of Weld County, the ordinance of Weld County that says in order to get sewer services for the town from the town of Johnstown, you must annex. That's what they're complaining about. If we get to the core issue here they are. They're adjacent to town of Johnstown. Three sides. They're eligible for annexation. They don't want to annex. we do not have to serve them with a sewer service unless they annex. It's not because of the town of John's regulations, even if you set that aside. State law allows us, as a condition of giving them sewer service, that they agree to annex to the town of Johnstown. And that state law provision is under section 31-12-121. It says very specifically, any municipality, as a condition precedent to the supplying of municipal services pursuant to contract, and if they're outside the boundaries of the town of Johnstown, they have to enter into a contract with us in order to get the sewer services, because our ordinances wouldn't apply to them since they're outside our jurisdiction. May require a contemporary agreement, which we would have done had they gone through the process, by such consumers, the Larsons, they would be the consumers. Owners in fee of real property so supplied, the Larson property, to apply for or consent to the annexation of the area to be supplied with municipal services. State law allows us to do that anyway. They haven't attacked state law. They have lots of hurdles to go over before they even get to that issue. This issue about attorney's fees, Mr. Cohen brought up the Lammer case. Yes, that is an old case. No, it hasn't been overturned. But there's some distinct issues here that are totally different from our case. First of all, Lambert, they had a verdict, number one. Number two, the condemner took possession of the property. They even put railroad tracks on the property. They did not move to dismiss their claim until after the verdict came in. Now, the other case that was referred to, the water case, as Mr. Cohen said, that case is American Water Development versus City of Alamosa. That case also, there was a final verdict. Many times the offer that was given on its face, yes, that sounds like quite a bit, but there's another issue that came up. There was partial summary judgment against American Water Development already, and they admitted, American Water Development admitted that they didn't have much of a chance if they went to trial, but they went to trial anyway. They went through the whole nine yards.
Well, counsel, it seems to me your client had a choice here. Could have moved for dismissal with prejudice, but it moved for dismissal without prejudice.
Yes.
So by doing so, you have placed the property and the owners under the cloud that you can simply reinstitute the action at any time.
But anybody in the entire community, anybody outside the community within a reasonable period of boundaries could be subject to condemnation. Not just them, anywhere we would want to point it. We didn't want to totally foreclose the opportunity and leave one property where we could never condemn again. And it's a matter of political reasoning too, because this whole council, it's on that five members on the council are up for re-election. I don't know what the next council may decide. But the reality is, the facts are this. At this point, because of the length of the litigation that this has taken, in 2008, that was when there was a big slide in economic conditions. The developer no longer had the ability to pay for installing a sewer line. In fact, they couldn't get a loan because of the lending practices had changed substantially. They could not get a loan to do that.
The developer are you talking about?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Say the developer, are you talking about Mr. Larson couldn't get a loan?
No. The developer I'm talking about is that, and they mentioned it too, the Larsons mentioned it in their briefs, that the developer was actually under agreement with us.
Adjacent land developer.
Yes, the adjacent to the Larson property.
Okay.
Under agreement with us that he would pay for the attorney's fees and the cost of putting in this sewer line across the Larson property. Based upon that, because that was there to serve their property, the developer's property. because of change in economic conditions, they couldn't get a loan to do that anymore.
Is that one of the reasons the trial court?
No. The reason for was the reason why we actually opted to dismiss the case was not only because of the economic conditions changing, but also because of the length of the litigation, the cost of the litigation with the Larsons. And we never thought that the Larsons would ever stop the litigation. In fact, they've even filed another case carrying the same issues in the same court. And that case was dismissed, but now it's on stay.
Mr. Hanson, let me ask you this. Are you aware of any distinction or difference in the nature of a condemnation proceeding that would prevent or prohibit the application of Rule 41A2? My question is, a condemnation proceeding different than other proceedings to which 41A2 would apply?
41A2 is going to apply to any action.
Okay.
Well, what we have here, we never took physical possession of the property. We didn't touch the property.
41A2 doesn't talk about that, though. No, 41A2 just talks about voluntarily dismissing your claim. And I understand your comment about not wanting to foreclose future condemnation proceedings, but the fact is here that you had already initiated one against the Larsons and dismissed it, and then kept open the opportunity to do it again, where I'm not sure that same scenario applied to these other properties that you might want to later condemn.
That's correct. We certainly didn't start any condemnation cases on any other property because this was the ideal property. But the difference is the fact that we haven't done anything to his property. We haven't foreclosed their opportunity either. What are their attorney's fees based upon? I think if you look at the decision of the trial court went through every possible scenario. Judge Tuttle was very thorough about that. Each potential issue that could garner attorney's fees, she went through every one of them and determined that attorney's fees were not appropriate for this matter as a condition of the voluntary dismissal of this case. And rule, of course, the rule of law would apply. Has there been an abuse of discretion? Because this court would affirm the decision of the trial court, because it is within the trial court's decision, unless and only unless there is shown an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, the only reason the court gave, and I'm looking at, the pages aren't numbered, but I'm looking at the court's order for denying a condition of attorney fees, was that the Larsons had avoided the condemnation by virtue of the dismissal. Well, that's true in every dismissal. The defendant wins as a matter by definition. So if that's a reason, you could never condition a dismissal on an award of fees. So how is that a valid reason for denying fees?
The fact that on dismissal, and if we are not going to condemn the property, then they have no residual damages. There are no damages. All the other reasons that they followed through supported the fact that no attorney's fees should be awarded. And I don't know what else.
Such as what? I mean, the court gave one reason, and the reason was simply that essentially defendants had prevailed, or respondents had prevailed. Defendants always prevail on a dismissal of plaintiff's claim.
Yes, if everything's dismissed.
Right,
that's
and
unless,
you
must. Yeah. Unless there is a counterclaim, which there never was.
Right, but I guess my point is that seems to be a conflation. It seems to me to be saying, well, I'm going to apply the American rule here. You prevail, but so what? The American rule applies, but that's not 41A2. That's not what 41A2 does.
I would argue, did they prevail? There wasn't a verdict. The only thing that happened when that case went back is one thing. A trial date was set 6 months afterwards. There's no discovery. There were no motions filed. Nothing was done. Only that setting of the trial date. Nothing else.
But they had to spend a lot in attorney fees to get to that point. 3 years of litigation. And then your client says, never mind.
The, which they have a right to do, it was their appeal.
You may have a right to do it, but not necessarily without consequence. I mean, it seems to be that's what you're saying. That there can be no consequence for spending 3 years in litigation and then simply trying to walk away under 41A2. Your client could have walked away under 41A1, dismissal with prejudice, but chose a different route.
We didn't specifically say that we wanted the case dismissed without prejudice, but that is the result of happening if you don't state whether it's with prejudice or without prejudice. Even though they ran one on that one issue, they lost on a half a dozen other issues in that first appeal. But in the first appeal, they're asking for attorney's fees there. They were not awarded in the first appeal.
But that's a separate issue from 41A2. That's a, you know, frivolous and groundless or fee shifting issue. That's not what 41A2 is about. 41A2 is about conditions to protect the defendant. And this defendant is faced with the prospect of future litigation because you've chosen to dismiss without prejudice. They would have to incur much of these fees over again if your client changes its mind after the next election. That's what 41A2 is there for.
That is a possibility. It may be remote, but it is a possibility. I can't predict what the future will turn. I think a lot of what the judge also found is the fact that if you don't build that sewer line, there aren't any residual damages. And I guess the only issue is whether they should be compensated for the attorney's fees they already spent in the case. And the town, I can't answer that other than to say the town of Johnstown likewise expended those fees. And the issues were raised because of the fact that they appealed. They have a right to appeal, but the issues that led to that appeal was not because of the fact that we went through a through prevented them from testifying other than the one issue that we objected to, which was the failure to disclose the comparables as required by the rules of civil procedure. The court found.
Mr. Anson, I'm sorry, you're out of time, sir.
Thank you.
We appreciate your argument. Thank you both, counsel, for your argument this afternoon. This case will likewise stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.